Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to this podcast, Yovana the Ageless, where our mission is to unleash everything about living ageless in collaboration with the experts in ancient healing practices from all across the world. Yovana the Ageless is an experiential ancient lifestyle online platform with focus on ageless living. This space has emerged from our innate desire to impart knowledge and experience on living ageless at body, mind, and consciousness level. Yovana ecosystem is all about knowledge sharing and living a traditional lifestyle driven from a medley of worldly timeless wisdom of yoga, Ayurveda, traditional Chinese medicine, microbiotics, Qigong, and raw alkaline and living food philosophy. At Yovana, we share this timeless wisdom in collaboration with experts through this podcast and courses on our Yovana platform conducted by global experts in ancient modalities. On this platform, we discuss everything from foods to rituals to lifestyle to yogic and ancient movement practices like Qigong, Ayurveda, and much more. Here you learn to live a way of life to regain Yovana, the youth, living by the Rith, the universal order of healing and agelessness. We invite you to realize the divinity of your innate potential to remain ageless with us on this platform, Yovana.
Hi, Tara. Hi. How are you?
I am well. Good. Thank you. Nice to see you.
Great. And thank you so much for being there on this podcast. And the whole idea on this podcast for us is to talk about these, bring to the surface these Eastern ancient modalities and talk about the knowledge that these ancient sciences carry. So, and since you have been into one of these modalities, working on it for quite a long time and have your own experiences, so we really feel privileged to have you here and, you know, listen to your experiences. So Tara, I'll introduce you first and then I'll ask my questions. Tara Mitra is an authorized Ashtanga teacher level 1 and level 2 and a certified yoga therapist in the Krishnamacharya tradition. She is passionate about Vedic mantra chanting and dedicatedly practices rituals. She has been practicing and teaching for over 19 years. Tara has practiced with only certified teachers over the years and visits India often to be with her teachers. She also continues to study Ayurveda. She's a trained chef and combines her nutrition knowledge with her yoga practice. So, so much to talk about with you, Tara, but I think we'll first start with the very basics. Please share with us the beginning of your yoga journey.
Sure, definitely. Thank you. It's nice to be here. I began practicing, it was 2003, middle of 2003. And I was practicing when I was living in, so I grew up in Canada, but I was had a very, very hectic position within restaurants. And I was working in Whistler in British Columbia. And I started practicing to reduce the stress from my job. And I remember going to the sweetest class, and I just loved it. I found, wow, this is something amazing. I feel so relaxed and calm. And it was like nothing else I'd ever experienced. So I had been studying the mind. I love the mind. And so I studied self-studied psychology for over 10 years. But then I began practicing yoga and put it all together. But yeah, it all started in Whistler in Canada, in a small town in Canada.
Yeah, so I guess for a lot of practitioners, it starts with some health concern and gradually you realize it's much more than what you come to it with. So so from being a very success, you know, being in a very successful career in the past, and how has been your yoga journey? Like, it's not easy to give up a really fulfilling job, a successful career, and starting all afresh in a new career. So how has been your yoga journey,
Oh, that's a good question. I think my family thought I was losing my mind when I left. And I think most people did, because I left when I was probably in a position. Again, it was an 18-year career and then 2 years of consulting. And after leaving, I mean, I think the journey in itself, it was, I knew there was something else to do. I knew there was something bigger. I've always been a teacher as long as I can remember. It's just the subject matter changes. And I just didn't, I felt unhappy. I wasn't happy no matter how much money or however, whatever you'd call success, you know, in this idea, this world of, it was very gluttonous. You know, I was in restaurants. I was a multi-unit restaurant director, a sommelier, and a trained chef. It's lovely, but at the same time, it was a very gluttonous career and it's tiring. And I was working long days between 80 and 100 hours a week. So the transition, I didn't, you know, what I really liked about the job the most was that there was this idea, the knowledge was endless. Yeah. And mind is in the yoga journey, it's very similar. The knowledge is endless. There are so many different, the Vedas, Upanishads, Yoga Sutras, like all of these different, shastras. There's just so much to learn, and so
That's true.
that's what I loved the most about it. So I find the transition perhaps was easy, though. I fought very hard to be in the career that I was in. I was quite young when I started, and then I was a girl, a female, and not only a female, I'm half Indian, so I'm of color. And so all of these different
Yeah,
things
sure.
were continually against me. But when I started yoga and when I started teaching, it was one of the easiest things that I've ever transitioned into. So.
Yeah. And how did Ashtanga practice find you?
Aha. So in my very curious
Yeah.
state, as being an ex-runner, I used to run when I was young. For years and years, so and I loved it, like competitive running. And so when I was practicing, when I found started practicing yoga, I would just go to all of the classes that were really active. I would find
Okay.
really wanted to get this this extra rajas that I had out, and that was what I needed at the time. And I found that all of the classes that I was going to, I were that were active were, all based, so power, Jivamukti. There was an Ashtanga blend, and I think it was called Maya. All of these were based and coming from Ashtanga. And so when I did that research and looked at it, I realized that. And then I started looking up teachers in Ashtanga. So that's how the journey started. And then I found Johnny Smith. Well, actually, I took a trip to India first. And then I came back, and then I started practicing with Johnny Smith in Sebastopol.
Okay, perfect. So, how did being a yoga therapist happen along with Ashtanga practice? I guess, I mean, again, you will have to educate us on that. Is there any similarity between the two modalities?
It's a beautiful question. I love this. The modalities are a little bit different. So the training was quite intensive. So the training
For
is, and
Ashtanga or for the yoga therapist?
I guess for both, but for it to be a yoga
Okay.
therapist, because we have to look at all the conditions in the body. Yeah, to be an Ashtanga teacher, I mean, to be a really good one, I apprenticed for 6 years and 4 years with Saraswati Joyce every day for in her shala in Mysore, India, and she had a very beautiful way of just teaching me everything. So, from lessons on the ego, all the other postural things, I had come in with some knowledge because I had been assisting already in California for 2 years. But she really took the chanting and other practices seriously. Now, yoga therapy, the reason I started studying yoga therapy was because of the amount of injury that I noticed. And so, not necessarily. I'm a teacher, but usually it was a lot of self-infliction because, it's Mysore and it's intense when people travel all over the world to get to Mysore and they're in this room and then here I am. And so I think there's just a huge amount of intensity. And I just witnessed a lot of injury. And I kept thinking, if I had to help somebody, really, really help someone, I wouldn't know what to do. If someone came in sick, if they have really hurt their back, if they really, have PCOD, or depression, I can't give them Surya Namaskar and hope it will go away. And so I wanted to understand. I really wanted to learn more. And I knew that Krishnamacharya was teaching like this. And that originally that Ashtanga was taught where everyone was in the room, everyone was allowed. And not that it's not now, everyone is still allowed in the room, but people that were really sick were all together. And I wanted to be able to have that space. I wanted to understand more, and I wanted to know what would happen if someone did come in and they were sick and how to help them. And so I started to go towards Chennai. I followed Krishnamacharya's path, as best as I could. And I found his lineage that continued in Chennai, and I started practicing with Lakshmi Ranganathan. She was my first yoga therapy teacher. Really beautiful, really powerful. She's the first teacher at K1, so very, very knowledgeable. And she began to teach me, and she decided that, you know, I have a lot of questions, and I'm continually curious. So I had a lot of questions, and I wanted to know more. So she suggested a formal training with one of Deskachar's students. And so I completed that course, and I study continually because it's nonstop. And
it's endless. It's actually endless.
Absolutely. And we're talking about the human mind. Yeah. So this is the base of all of it is that. So yoga therapy is, it's when you train for it, it's including Ayurveda, it includes the Shastras, it includes the Yoga Sutras. We need to understand, and a lot of looking at ourselves. How are we coming out through the world? How are we connecting and interacting in the world?
Okay, so which means like both Ashtanga practice or any kind of yoga practice and yoga therapy goes hand in hand. It's not separate. Like it's not a different approach to practicing. It's about blending everything in together, which makes you as a whole, completes you.
It depends. It really depends on what's happening, right? So if there's a wobbly ankle, but everything else is okay, so then we adjust the practice in order to, or give us a sub practice in order to strengthen up the ankle. Now, there's a concept of if you get really injured, say you threw out your back, that you would stop your regular Ashtanga practice, take a yoga therapy program, do the therapy program, strengthen up your back again, and then go back to your practice. You're not supposed to stay in a therapy place. But okay. Also with other people, I teach a lot of one-to-one classes as well. And that's what Krishnamacharya did his whole life, is that some people don't want to be in a group class, and some people have, you know, work in different ways. So, I mean, if I'm working with, I work with a lot of trauma, post-traumatic stress, or mental health like schizophrenia. If we're working with these, sometimes it's better to do one-on-one classes first and then move into a group environment. So it really, really depends. It's not just, they're not completely separate. So yoga therapy depends on what the issue is. So it can be a practice that either gets you back to your regular practice, or it can be a separate practice as a whole that's just for used as a therapy. Yeah, for certain people that are older or rheumatoid arthritis, like sometimes the Ashtanga practice is just too much. And so Ashtanga,
Okay, go ahead. So I have a very curious question, specifically about yoga therapy. So what we are trying to understand here is that there are two aspects to yoga therapy. One is the physical side, where if in any injury happens to during your practice for any reason, there is a certain way of practicing yoga where you can start to bring about healing in the body. And simultaneously, there's another angle where you start to work with the mind. So you work with a lot of people with, I believe, on both the sides. What has been your experience on the healing side, specifically on the emotional front? Also considering that stress is something that's really gripping us in today's times, and people actually don't know where to go when it comes to kind of taking control of their stress. It could be some quick tools that they apply, or in extreme cases they might just want to visit a psychologist or go ahead with the medications. Do you think all of this is needed, or yoga therapy is complete in itself to bring about really drastic changes in the emotional states of a person?
Yeah, it's a good question. It really depends on the person. Yeah. Okay. And so that's the thing, it's very individualized. And so I think, you know, if it's a very deep-rooted problem that's been happening for a very long time, then yes, sometimes medication is required. It doesn't mean that they come off their medication altogether, but maybe it's reduced. Yeah, and so it's so hard to answer the question, because it's really about the person standing in front of me. And so how are they interacting? Yeah. Tell you something and then tell somebody else the same thing, and both of you will have a very different response to it. And so I think yoga can be incredibly healing, but it is not a quick fix. It's a long, slow process, but it can, you know, when paired with Ayurveda and the right tools. I mean, some people don't want to look at their mind at all. They just want to hear, my leg hurts.
Exactly.
I want to do this practice. When the practice is done, you don't see them again. And so it really depends
That's
on
true.
That. Where other people to come in, and you know, I wouldn't necessarily be talking about the mind in the beginning either to anybody that started practicing yoga. I would just, you just practice, and it naturally happens. You know, the shifts will naturally happen, and then when they're ready, you know, after a few years of practice, then it's the time. You know, at any given point, we have to look at the deeper practices: pranayama, meditation, chanting. Is Shastra. The Shastra helps us to understand ourselves. All of yoga is about understanding ourselves.
Yeah? That's true.
To be able to reverse, you know, start looking at the old vasanas or the old samskaras that are formed and recreating them, because this is the process of change. If we can actually look at these old vasanas and find out what the source of them are and be able to reprogram. And this is deep work. This is the deeper levels of yoga, and it takes a lot of diligence, and people have to really want to do the work, because yoga is way beyond asana. So the physical is just one small part that is there to help us to get into the deeper layers of yoga.
True. And Tara, on the physical side, again, a curious question, and it's coming from my own personal experience. I guess about two years back, while getting into a headstand, I don't know, some injury happened to me, which I did not realize. I was quite comfortable in the posture. I came down well and everything was all okay. But the only problem was I did not do the warm-up first. So I just immediately got into a headstand, and that was somewhere around 12 o'clock in the morning, and I did my practice under the sun. By 7-ish in the evening, I started to have a very severe pain in my starting from here, and which was gripping me till my fingertips. And I thought maybe something must have happened. And next day it became worse. I couldn't move this side at all. And there was no position where I was getting relief at all. Probably some nerve must have, was compressed. And for next about 2 months, it was completely unbearable. I couldn't sleep at night. I used to wake up at night, and I visited certain doctors, and ultimately, I just came across a chiropractor who kind of helped me. He did some 3-4 sessions on me, and then that thing became okay. And then and when it became okay, that this chiropractor also told me that for you, for a lifetime, headstand is a no-no. Rather, any inversion is a no-no where you're putting strain on your neck or shoulders, which of course I did not take those words. I just tried that again and started back again. But the idea is, such kind of injuries are common to a lot of people. And I really wish I had a hang of yoga therapy at that time, where I could, you know, kind of understand what exactly went wrong and what is the approach to healing it. So, you know, how would yoga therapy look at such conditions, which can immediately just grow up without you even knowing, and then you are clueless what to do next?
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful question. Yeah, but it's a beautiful question, and it's a great example of why the practice, you know, all of the warm-ups is a very common thing, and I've done it myself so many times, just jumping into postures and the like. But definitely it's probably coming from the neck. But you know, yoga therapy, I mean, if somebody came with that, we'd have to sort of understand exactly like what was going on. Seeing the chiropractor is a great idea, and my husband's a chiropractor, so when I'm working,
it's a great combination for sure. Now I realize it's like, you know, injuries are so common while you practice.
Absolutely. And he's more like, he's Gonstead, so it's a holistic chiropractic. And so they do go very, very well together. So usually something like that, I would bring him into the session. So I generally have, between him and I also work with an Ayurveda doctor. And so I feel that that's very complete. But we'd have to understand what happened. We'd do different movements. I'd create a program. Yeah, it's because when there's an injury or when something happens, the biggest mistake is just to stop everything. Yeah, because you still need to get some movement in and just to figure out so it doesn't lock up. So it's really, really individual, but that's what I would do. I would sort of take a look, find out the movements, see if there's anything else happening and stemming from the body. But yeah, because you'd have to look at the shoulder.
Does that also happen because of the alignment issue?
It could be so many things. It sounds like there was probably partially alignment, partially maybe there wasn't enough strength in the upper body, the shoulders. There might not have been enough strength, and also pressure on their head, because in a headstand there's no pressure on the head whatsoever. It should be all the weight in the forearms, and just being able to, you know, stabilize the scapula, stabilize everything, and then be able to come up.
That's true. Yeah. So, okay. Coming back to Ashtanga Dhara again, like you have learned from authorized and certified teachers only throughout your practice, or since you started learning. So, and there are a lot of yoga schools happening now. A lot of teachers coming in. So, what difference do you see in the quality of your practice when it comes from the authorized and certified teachers as compared to ones who are just kind of course, maybe taking the lineage ahead, but just learning and imparting the knowledge, learning, imparting the knowledge. Probably there's no deeper a sense to that kind of a practice. So do you see any difference working with such teachers?
Yes, I'd say my teachers have only been, everybody has been certified. Yeah. And so I tend to like to practice under teachers that have lots of experience. Yeah. For me, to take in the information and to pass along the information, I feel they have to have a good understanding of yoga themselves. So I'm not, the authorization certificate, all this stuff is like, who's the person and who are their teachers? And how have they learned and what did they learn? Yeah, because for me, the piece of paper doesn't really justify or say this person's a wonderful teacher now all of a sudden because there's this piece of paper. The only reason I've chose certified teachers though is because I knew that they were minimum, for most of the ones that I practice with were practicing a minimum of 20 years, most of them 30 or more. And so I wanted to basically work with people that have a mature practice, a good understanding of themselves through the practice as well, because it's all transference. If I'm going to go to a teacher, I want to make sure that that teacher is going to transfer pure knowledge to me, something that they've experienced. So that's something that I've always thrived for. And with my teachers, I make sure I try to the best of my ability from what I see, because I can only see from where I'm looking, is that my teachers have learned and learned well from good spaces and have pure hearts. I think that's more important than anything else. And do they know it? And of course, I'm a very traditional person, so yes, I believe that the knowledge should not be shifted or changed in any which way. So paper or not, there can be authorized teachers that are really like rigorous, and that's not how it was ever taught. I've been doing research all the way back. And yoga, there should be no control in yoga. Yeah, there's yoga is about healing, and it should remain a space of healing and kindness and open, but also disciplined and dedicated. And there should be kindness and compassion. These are important spaces that we create. So that's I find also teachers that I get along with, and they generally have those characteristics. Yeah.
No, but I guess that's really a beautiful perspective because since beginning when I started and I had a lot of peers along with me, I guess this was one of the missing aspect with a lot of practitioners. Their only idea was just to learn 200-hour TTC and just immediately get into teaching. So I guess this perspective is very important. Where is it actually coming from? Is that lineage being carried forward? And so I guess this is one aspect that's really missing in a lot of seekers who want to really get deeper into yoga. So okay, so also share your experience learning the Ashtanga practice right at its source in Mysore.
Beautiful. Yeah, it was so I started when I first started, Saraswati and Sharat were still teaching together. And so I used to practice with Sharat when he'd come to visit in the US when I was living there. And then in the summertime when I went, Sharat and Saraswati were together. And then I didn't realize, but I went and practiced one summer with Saraswati, and then I was assisting her. And then I started hearing everyone saying, oh, well, you can't switch back and forth. Because I said, oh, I'll go back to Sharat and practice in September. And everyone's like, no, you can't do that. And I was like, oh. So I went to speak to Saraswati. And I said, Saraswati Ma, I explained what was happening. And I said, I was thinking to go back to Sharat, but I think one teacher. So what should I do? And I said, should I go back or do I stay with you? And she looked at me and she said, very good question. She says, you are my student, you stay with me. And she meant it. She really did. She took it very seriously. And for at least the first 2 years, were really, really beautiful and intense. Like I spent so much time with her next to her and just watched, and she showed me, you know, everything from adjustments to chanting. She really loved chanting. And I had already liked chanting, but when I practiced with her, she really ignited that, my love for chanting. And so through the, in the room, she would be playing the Maha Ganesha Pancharatnam while we were walking through, and then ask me to chant with her. But then she also did tests. She's tested my ego. Like I watched her a few different times, and she's tested how I behaved with people. And we just got very, very close. Yeah. And then it was to the point where, you know, I had a very special relationship with Saraswati. I have. I just saw her recently. And it's so beautiful. I mean, it's very, I feel very blessed and very lucky, because it's quite rare to have that experience with such a busy shala. And, you know, there's almost 200 students that are passing through, and to be able to be there with her. And not only that, to see so many different body types and to adjust so many people. I think there is no amount of training that could have taught me what I learned about the human body, with thousands and thousands and thousands of bodies. Because, you know, when I was in LA assisting, there was about 60 students, which maybe 30 came in regularly that I was adjusting. And then to come into this space and really like have access to thousands and thousands, like I said, of people, it was really, it taught me so very much. Yeah. And that's,
no, that's true. I mean, yeah. That experience definitely is priceless. You cannot, you know, I mean, having the, and being there at, right at the source, learning it is something that's beyond even learning that practice. So, Tara, now, my question is more from the perspective of a beginner wanting to get into learning this practice, and specifically the age concern, because Ashtanga practice being really an intense practice. There is some understanding that Ashtanga, for the people to start Ashtanga, you should start early in your early years because of its intensity. Your body supports that. How true is that? Like, is age a concern when you start your Ashtanga practice?
I don't think so. No, and it's, everybody is so individual. I know I keep saying this, but you know, you may have, I've seen students in their 70s that are just, you know, they have a lot of energy and they have to, they want to do something with it. So it's practice, go ahead. But if the practice is depleting you, then don't practice it. If the practice is feeding you, then practice it. So it really depends on it. Not necessarily. I think it's, you know, depending if you're coming in for the circus act, you know, the part of it, the handstand. Yeah. So many people come into it. And, you know, I really loved it. And until I had,
I guess it starts with that. For a lot of people, it starts with that, and gradually you realize, as you said, you know, you evolve and you realize it's much more than just getting into those postures.
Exactly. By the time you get those postures, you don't really need them or want them anymore. By the time I had, you know, I was doing TikToks and Vrishikasana, I wasn't interested in having them. I'm like, I'm okay. So I think,
I know.
Yeah, I think it just,
it's normal to feel like that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I don't think there's any age group. And it's also how you practice. Yeah, there's so many. We don't have to go really hardcore. You don't have to do every single vinyasa. You know, it's supposed to be adjusted for the person. And so depending, you know, when I had shoulder injuries, I didn't do vinyasas because I couldn't. And so I practiced my full practice, but I didn't. I took out the vinyasas and it did a world of wonders for my shoulder.
Great. So I think you've just you just mentioned about depletion. So, you know, my next question again is a practical question. Like, for a lot of people who get into yoga, initially may tend to feel depleted. Is it because, do you think that they're just starting their journey? Or is it also because it could be something related to deficiencies in their dietary patterns? Since you're also a trained chef, and I believe you combine a lot of dietary aspects to your practice. And basis your experience, what do you see is a probable reason? It's just the beginning to this to the practice, or could be some nutritional deficiencies coming in?
It could be a lot of different things. It could be nutritional. Most likely it's the breath. Most likely it's the incorrect breathing. Yeah, and the incorrect breathing, because it takes a long time to learn how to breathe. Yeah, if you watch Mary Chasana D or these twists, if there's a... You know, all of a sudden,
that's true.
It's just completely shifted. And so until we learn how to breathe properly. Everything is linked. So if the breath is incorrect, it can cause a lot of imbalance. Yeah. The other thing is if the diet's incorrect, and usually people that are just coming in, that may, it could be dietary as well. If there are deficiencies, yes, you know, that's something completely different. That a practice of any practice, if you started or not, should not deplete you. It should energize you. So you'll know automatically if you're depleted, then something is off with the practice, because you shouldn't feel like that. So either the nutrition is off, or the breath is not correct. Something is certainly off, but yeah, the practice, like I said, should really, you should finish the practice and feel boom, good energy. Yeah.
Great. So that brings me to another question. Like if we look at the modern understanding of how the fitness industry goes, there's a lot of focus on specifically on protein. The specific intense practice of Ashtanga in the Ashtanga community, is protein is it talked about, or is it like normal thing? Like, you know, as long as you're consuming your normal diet and good diet, it's all okay. You're good to practice. How does that understanding go in the Ashtanga community?
Yeah, well, I haven't heard a lot of talk about, you know, there's a lot of, this will be a lot of talk about veganism and should we do this, like from a different standpoint. But I think, again, it's individual. Yeah. You know, for yoga, it is talked about ahimsa. Yes. Yeah, so non-violence from that certain aspect. But if somebody's body requires something, then you have to have what your body requires. Yeah. Ayurveda says something very different. Where they say to eat meat. So I personally I'm vegetarian. I only have ghee. This is the only thing, but you know, we have to have ghee to stay healthy, I believe, for my constitution anyways.
That's strengthening enough, I believe. I mean, ghee, you actually can feel the differences once you start incorporating ghee in your diet.
Absolutely. And it's not just what we eat. It's also the, how we take care of ourselves, the entire dinacharya practices, right? So the oil baths, the tongue scraping, neti pot, like all of this is, are we cleaning out the system? Are we cleaning the nadis and then getting onto your mat? And so what we put into our bodies is also incredibly important. And, you know, I haven't heard a lot of talk about protein, but it's just, if you eat a really good balanced diet, whatever works for you, because each of us will have, you know, a certain carbohydrate that really is for us. Like mine is quinoa. Yeah, if I'm going to take a grain, anything, mine's quinoa. If I eat quinoa, I feel really energized. Yeah, no matter what, no matter
when. That's good plant quality protein automatically getting it into your diet with quinoa.
Exactly. And so we just figure out what works for us. And that's, I think, more than anything else, if there's any nutritional problems or it's just people really not understanding what works for them. So I always suggest a food log. Yeah, if you logged what you eat 30 minutes afterwards, write how you feel after everything that you eat. You'll know. Then you automatically start to learn what works for your system, what doesn't work for your system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the conscious approach to eating for sure.
Exactly.
So, okay, that is so for your own personal practice, like being a trained chef, you're also practicing Ayurveda. How do you bring in the elements of Ayurveda and diet to your practice? Like, do you eat by the seasons or on a regular daily basis? There is some element of understanding nutrition and bringing it into your diet to match your practice. How do you personally go about it?
Yeah, beautiful question. Absolutely. I do everything. Yes. According to seasons, right? We just had a season change here. We're going into spring. So that's one part of it. So definitely this is the time that we start to nurture the body and really get ready for summer, because summer we have to watch our ojas that it doesn't get depleted, or the vitality is what I should say is what this is. And then with my own daily practices, yes, I make plays on rasam. Like I do healthy Ayurvedic meals daily. So rasam is like an Indian spice soup, like a black pepper. But I won't put tomatoes in it because tomatoes are sour. They're not good for the system. I replace that and I either use blueberries or cranberries or asahi. I
know. Nice.
My Indian auntie's yelling, but
but I guess it's a good blend of Eastern and Western coming in together.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I try to do. And if I look at this foods and what the quality of the foods are, and if I know it has high vata or high vayu, like wind properties and I have access to my body, then I will use spices like jeera, what is it, cumin, and like different spices to reduce the effect of what's going to happen. And so I cook like this naturally. I mean, everything that I'm looking at, so between the daily rasam or kashayams, like, so I'll mix these, if there's a sore throat, yeah, I'll make kashayams. So I do this with everything. I make eye washes, I like everything. I think I'm my greatest experiment. I'm continually experimenting on what works inside, outside, on my skin, on my faces, oils, oil bath, everything. And I think it just helps to have a better balance, yeah, and just greater health.
It has a very grounding effect, I feel.
Absolutely.
That's what I like for a lot of people who visit my house. I keep telling them my kitchen is like a small Ayurveda laboratory. So, you know, just come in and, yeah. So, okay, Tara, so my next question is like talking about Ayurveda. So if you look at Ayurveda, there are different approaches to practice Ayurveda. It's, you can either, you know, imbibe it as a part of your lifestyle, following your or starting your day on the concepts of Dinacharya concept in Ayurveda, or you can just bring in the dietary aspect to it, or you can even bring in the herbology aspect to it. So, you know, in your practice or in your recommendations to your clients as well, what aspect of Ayurveda do you recommend which combines well with the yoga practice? Because these two being sister sciences, the healing by combining the two becomes really powerful. But, you know, because there are so many aspects to bringing in Ayurveda in your daily life, it's actually up to us what exactly do we want to start with or go ahead with. So, you know, what do you go ahead with when it is about Ayurveda coming in into your life and in your practice?
Yeah, beautiful. I usually would start, so first I start slow. Yeah, otherwise everyone would run away because it'd be too many changes. But I recommend some Dinacharya practices, so the daily practices, some that I was mentioning before, so like tongue scraping or the neti pot where you put water and Himalayan salt and do a nose rinse, a nasal rinse. Sometimes kashayams if there's throat problems, so you can do a gargle with different herbs. It really, really depends on the person. Sometimes we're using triphala quite a lot, that comes into play. But usually on these aspects of, you know, oil bath or just oil under the feet or behind the ears, it really depends on what's happening for the person. So they start there, and then definitely diet, because there's a lot of digestion issues. Yeah, there seems to be, if the digestive fire is off, then this is the cause of a lot of health issues, or main cause of health issues. So the digestive fire has to get fixed first. And so if the digestion is off, then everything else will get off. So I work a lot with trying to reboost the digestive fire, switching the diet, like I had said before, finding out what foods are working, what aren't, like a lot of different ways of working along the lines, just to make it individual as well. So,
when you mention focus on digestive concerns, is it only the dietary part that you look into, or do you also bring in certain yoga practices? Because stimulation of abdominal organs is one of the strong focus in Ayurveda, detox and cleansing practices as well. So do you try to combine the both of it, or to begin with it's just about, you know, correcting the diet and then gradually getting on to all these yogic practices for digestion?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, usually the digestion is in the apana, the apana vayu. So you have the five vayus within the body, the five different seats of vayu. And so this is the apana, sometimes samana, but mainly the apana region, which is the lower abdomen region. And so we do the combination, definitely. There are a lot of postures that can be worked, like apanasana, of course. It's named after the apana region, jataraparavritti. So certain postures are quite good for stimulating. And then pranayama. Yeah, if people are breathing correctly, the breath is going all the way down. Yeah, and this will also create digestion. And also you have to think that digestion is also, how are we digesting everything? Information as well. Yeah. And so and mental aspect of what's happening. Because sometimes if the mind is disturbed, then the digestion gets off. or sometimes the period gets off. Like if the mind, if we get very stressed, a lot of tension, then perhaps the period starts to stretch out 30, 40 days, sometimes 50 days. Yeah, sometimes we lose our periods if the body is too stressed. It's a big thing in Ashtanga, women lose periods because it's not enough nutrition, too much strain, maybe misunderstanding of bandhas. So there's so many different things to look at, but
I really want to add on something here. Like before getting onto this journey of yoga, I was, since I started my wellness journey as a macrobiotic nutritionist and then started different aspects of diet before actually delving deeper into yoga. So when I was practicing as a nutritionist, and my yoga journey had just started, it was that transitionary time. With a lot of clients, I started understanding that digestion, like though, you know, with dietary aspects, I was trying to help them to quite an extent. But then when I got into yoga, I actually realized that diet is one of the parts of it. It is very important, but it cannot be completely achieved until unless you bring about that stimulation in our digestive organs. It took me some time to realize that. And then when I had to kind of, you know, share that experiences with my clients, telling them, okay, it's not only foods that are going to make a difference. It's about bringing in that stimulation. It was really hard to pass on that information because the entire world, because of a lot of information floating in and people, you know, a lot of solutions actually coming in from the dietary perspective, people actually don't correlate that it's not only foods. Foods have a certain role to play, but it's more about that machinery that is processing that those foods. So yeah, gradually. So then, you know, I moved on from being a nutritionist to practicing yoga more because I realized yoga is much more powerful than what foods can do to you.
So beautiful. And the combination of the two is just so powerful.
It's powerful. Yes. And then when you bring in Ayurveda and all those cyclic changes in your way of life, then it takes you to a different level for sure. So, Tara, my next question is, what would be your advice to the beginners wanting to get deeper into their Ashtanga practice, or even the beginners who really want to, keen beginners who want to get deeper into understanding the traditional approach to yoga or being following the path of being a yoga therapist? What would be, what according to you, what would should be their starting point and your advice to them?
Yeah, beautiful. The starting point is find a good teacher. Yeah, you really, really need a good teacher. And like I said, a teacher that has learned from the right place and a teacher with a pure heart. This is very, very important. Yeah.
So is it important to learn all of this online, offline with a teacher or online? Because there's a lot of, it becomes really difficult to find out the right source considering there are a lot of options available. So is it like online serves equally well as offline, or it's about the teacher, whether you find it online or offline? How does that go?
I think with an Ashtanga practice, when you begin, you want to have somebody in person. Yeah, definitely for the physical practice, because they need to see your alignment. You need to hear the breath. There's so many things. Like, I mean, Krishnamacharya is known for saying the sign of a good teacher is the one that knows the student's breath. And really understand what's happening, because with the breath,
decoding the breath,
everything that's happening in the body, everything that's happening in the mind, we understand. And so I think physical, to find a good teacher. If you can't go there every day, at least once a week, go see a teacher. Drive wherever if you can. Usually there's, hopefully there's something around. Like I used to drive 45 minutes one way for my classes at 3 a.m. to arrive there.
3 a.m. Wow.
Oh yeah. And so I remember, you know, it's worth it, because the lessons, when you're beginning, you really have to have a solid foundation. Then you can learn at home. Then you can do online. But I think for asana classes, I don't teach asana online unless it's one-to-one classes, because charity class here and there. But I don't believe it's the best source. I think philosophy, chanting, other ways of being online, you can certainly have a teacher and learn that way. I still have all my teachers in India online, and it's not exactly the same as being in person, but it's still, the transference is there. And the knowledge there, which is beautiful. And so it's quite a gift, actually, to have access to online these days, to be able to access the teachers that we couldn't access before. But physically, definitely in person at least for 1 to 2 years until you really understand, because we have to understand what we're doing. We need to understand what our body's doing. And then even for that years, you still want to be working with a teacher. Like I've had, you know, yeah, I've had teachers for years and years and years and years. And so it makes, now I have, my main teachers are all chanting and philosophy. But because, you know, I know what to do asana wise, I know what my body wants to do. So
yeah,
20 years of practice, then I think I'm okay. I'll see somebody once in a while, but I know exactly what my body needs.
Great. And I guess it's also about that energy. Once you are in front of the a teacher, you know, I guess a lot of your inhibitions just go off. You know, you are in front of the right person.
Yeah. Exactly.
So great. So Tara, like, you know, you have like you've seen the best of both worlds. You have seen how yoga happens in the Western culture and how yoga actually is about that core deep traditional knowledge back in India at its source. So do you see any gap in the Western understanding of specifically Ashtanga practice and the Indian approach to Ashtanga practice, considering that, you know, there's a lot of focus on Ashtanga Vinyasa practice specifically outside India? So in terms of practically approaching the practice, do you see that all the elements, the traditional elements of Ashtanga are being practiced in the Western countries the way it comes from the source?
Yeah, I would say I haven't been in I guess the only times I've been into other shalas lately is if I'm teaching. So I don't know. This is where I'm like, well, I haven't been in a group class or seen how it's taught, actually, to be honest. I can say I've noticed and seen a lot of people doing postures that they shouldn't be doing or that isn't good for them. And so I think it's not I don't know if I would say East or West. I think it's just a lack of knowledge, to be honest. And I think
And I guess that's where a teacher is important.
Yeah. And even for teachers, a teacher is important. You have to continually have teachers, because how can we know what's happening with us? That's the mirror. Yeah. The teacher is the mirror that tells us what's, you know, what needs to be looked at, a good teacher. So I think I can only say from a general view, and from my students that have, most of my students are yoga teachers. And what I do appreciate is that there's this big curiosity now, a huge curiosity to learn more traditionally. So I have a lot of teachers that are coming to me for private chanting classes and you know, talking and also for philosophy, just having these discussions about wanting to go deeper. And I think this is a beautiful shift in the way that the world is moving, is that if you want to honor this, you know, this concept that Guru Shishka Parampara, and understand that we have this beautiful gift that's passed to us, and how it's passed to us, we should cherish it. Yeah. And as we keep it, then we keep the lineage. It's not about making ourselves famous or I'm going to change it and make it into this new brand of yoga. This is what we've received. And can I teach it with the best of my ability? Can I be genuine? And can I not hurt this person in front of me? And not only not hurt them, can I help them to lead a better life, to have a better sense of well-being, to be happier, to find more joy? I think this is one of the biggest problems with the world now, is that it's so intense. We've lost our connection with joy. It's like, go outside and play. Everyone's like, what? I'm like, go outside and play. You know, all the things we used to do when we've
forgotten that, actually.
Yeah, we've forgotten that. Yeah. And that's what we need to do. I'm like, just jump around, go look at the butterflies, go watch the birds smile, laugh, dance, just, you know, have fun.
And guys, it doesn't come naturally also. Like, I look at the younger generation, specifically my daughters as well. It's quite a challenge to, you know, take them out, even to the park, and, you know, and they'll be quite bored. What do we do here? What are we doing here? So you have to really teach them again, okay, watch this, and then, you know, realize how wondrous it is. So, yeah, that definitely is a gap for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Tara, I'm done with my questions. Anything on the ending note that you would want to add on for the listeners?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, I think... I think we've covered it. It's more or less, you know, practice. You know, if you can't find a teacher, just practice. Like I said, with somebody with a good heart, I think the most important thing is that if we practice, but it is the duty once you start to practice is to, you know, practice well, practice and learn well. If you're going to be a yoga teacher, teach well. Yeah. Learn. If you don't know something, don't pretend you know it. Go find the source. Go ask somebody. Yeah, this is bringing in more clarity into the world. Yeah, and more insight. And you know, that's what we require. We have a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of things that are information coming at us so quickly all the time. So it's the most beautiful thing to just pause, put everything down, reconnect back to our breath, reconnect back to the earth. And just, you know, we weren't meant to be, you know, we're somehow in these offices with artificial air and artificial lights and working around the clock, and we're losing our connection to the most beautiful thing, the, you know, the rhythms of nature. So whenever you can, like I said, get outside and play and ask yourself what brings you joy. One of my favorite questions, what brings you joy? And answer it. Yeah. See if you find it.
That says it all for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. But one thing when you were just mentioning, one thing that I just that just clicked to me was you very beautifully mentioned the rhythms of the nature, and I think rather that would be my last question again. You know, in the specifically Ashtanga practice, and I guess various other lineages also honor that fact that on certain days in a month you should not be practicing, like the full moon day, and for women there are certain days which was obvious for sure, but specifically on the full moon concept, or you know, or taking breaks during those specific days in the lunar cycle, what is the ideology behind that?
Yeah, definitely. Well, the moon days are generally, like, if you look at the ocean's a beautiful, we were living by the ocean for 3 months, mm-hmm. and you watch as the moon's sight, it's just mm-hmm. fascinating to just watch the water moving out and then coming back in, the tide coming up and taking the entire beach out. And then all of a sudden, then you have almost 50 feet of beach like a few weeks later. And so it's said that, you know, our body is made up of water. Yeah, where the majority of us is made up of water. And so we really connect to the rhythms of nature with this way. And so we should honor that and respect it. And so on the full moon that we become more active, this is the theory. And so if we're more active, and on the new moon, we become more passive, more relaxed, usually a little bit lethargic. And both of those days are said that if that's happening, that too much energy or too less energy, that
too
there's
low energy.
Too low energy, exactly. There is an ability to injure ourselves. And so it was made so that we don't injure ourselves. So we become more mindful in our practices. And plus, those are beautiful days for other practices anyways. It doesn't mean you don't have to do, so don't do your asana or do a light practice. And that's my personal belief. And mm-hmm. do pranayama meditation. Moon days are beautiful for meditation. Yeah, these other practices, there's so many other things you can do. And with the lady cycle, I know there's different schools of thought here, but from a yoga therapist aspect, I believe we should not practice. Yeah, you're supposed to let your body rest. It has been written in every, you know, all of these Ayurveda and all the scriptures, let the body rest. And it's not for anything else. It's a time to nurture. It's a time that, you know, we really need to embrace and just have this space of pure, utter relaxation without having any mental disturbances. You know, there were times, you know, where the lady is supposed to just be so relaxed, no cooking, no nothing. The kitchen gets closed. Usually a family member or somebody will bring food, and ultimately just relax. There's nothing disturbing, no disturbing movies, no disturbing messages, nothing, because it's such a powerful time in the for females that we need to nurture, and we also need to take care of our bodies, nurture our bodies, eat well. We should really be resting and eating quite well at that time as well. You know, internal oils, there's all kinds of things that we should be eating in order to keep the nutrients high at that time. So I believe, you know, and then there's also the question, well, what if my cycle's only 2 days? What if my cycle's only 7 days? What if my cycle's this? It's depending on the person, of course, and depending on you, but usually 3 days is a rest day. It's very nice to take that time.
Okay. From a different school of thought, I do agree what you said, but practically, if we look at how things happen today, most of the women today are working, and stress anyways, even if they want, they cannot avoid. There's so many responsibilities in a day to cater to, and for a lot of women, doing some kind of practice grounds them or brings them back to balance. So I guess from that school of thought, some supportive practices that can actually help them elevate their moods and bring about some energy levels, I believe that should be okay. What's your take on that?
It depends, right? As long as there's no pressure on the abdomen. Yeah, there should be no pressure, no aversions, right? The apana is moving, the energy is moving one way. It shouldn't flow the opposite way. Yeah, everything should be going certain space. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, if they want to do a gentle practice, absolutely. Again, pranayama. Pranayama is one of the best things that you can be doing at that time. Yeah, and so I'm a very big believer in those practices. And of course, we're active. So, we'd be realistic. So, and of course, for grounding to be going out in the world, yeah, I would definitely suggest pranayama or meditation. They're wonderful practices.
And just to add on, since you just mentioned the apana thing going downwards, when this injury that I just mentioned, which happened in my shoulder, that was the first day of my cycle, and I went into an inversion without a move, warm up. So probably, I don't know if that energy could have hit here, or I don't know, that could be one of the theories, coming out of it.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, very, very interesting.
Mm. Yeah. Great. So thank you, Tara. I guess I'm done with my questions. So anything on the ending note you would want to add on, or else I think we are done with the session.
No, I think that's it. I think the only other thing is, yeah, just find the way. It doesn't mean that also practice has to start with asana. I think that's an important thing to know as well. Like, this is there for people, but there's also other ways to come into the practice. You can also come in through chanting, you can come in through meditation, you can come in through others. So the practice is there, but the practice is not the end goal. I think that's the most important thing, is the practice is to support our limbs to be strong and healthy so that we can live well and we can do the other practices. It's really so that we can sit for long periods of time. Yeah, to be able to sit in pranayama or meditation for an hour, we need to be able to sit without having, oh, my back in 20 minutes, or my knee, or this is hurting, that's hurting, right? And so we need the stability of the body to be able to help stabilize the mind. And so
great. And also let us know, where can our listeners find you and the kind of offerings that you have in your specific, expertise in the yoga lineage.
Absolutely. They can always find me online. So I teach quite a lot online. I teach a lot of chanting online and philosophy and one-to-one yoga classes. And I also teach global workshops. So I'm going to, in April, I'll be in France and then Germany. And then I'll be coming to Canada. I'll be in Toronto. And then throughout United States, I'll be in Ohio, Texas, Nashville, New Jersey. So we'll be in a few places. Yeah.
Great. So all the best to you, Tara, for whatever comes your way in future. And thank you so much for being there. It was really lovely talking to you.
Yeah, it was lovely to talk to you as well. For inviting me.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.